Welcome back to another episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And our guest today is Russell Moore. He's the Chief Experience Officer of the USS Hornet Sea, Air, and Space Museum, an institution very near and dear to my heart in Alameda, California. We'll give Russ a chance to talk about his work on the Hornet, but I'll just say that if you're ever in the San Francisco Bay Area and are interested in naval or space history, do not pass up a chance to visit the Hornet. Russ has written a book titled USS Hornet CV-12, Service in War and Peace, and has also written magazine articles on a wide assortment of World War II topics. Welcome, Russ.
Thanks for having me, guys.
We're excited to have you. Hal, what's this minute of the movie about?
Well, I think I'm glad you asked that, Brian. This is minute 10. At the Army Enlistment Center in New York City, Steve Rogers, slight and determined, faces the physician examiner. "Is there anything you can do?" Steve asks, his voice earnest. "I'm doing it," the examiner replies, stamping Steve's file with a large 4F. "I'm saving your life." Later, in a dimly lit movie theater, Steve watches a newsreel, its patriotic fervor filling the screen. The narrator's voice booms. "War continues to ravage Europe, but help is on the way. Every able-bodied young man is lining up to serve his country. Even little Timmy is doing his part collecting scrap metal. Nice work, Timmy." A man in the audience, loud and brash, interrupts. "Who cares? Play the movie already." Steve leans forward, his jaw tight. "Hey, you want to show some respect?" The narrator continues. "Meanwhile, overseas, our brave boys are showing the Axis powers that the price of freedom is never too high." "Let's go. Get on with it," the man shouts. "Hey, just start the cartoon." Steve turns, his voice sharp. "Hey, you want to shut up?" The man stands, towering over Steve's small frame. The narrator drones on. "Together with allied forces, we'll face any threat, no matter the size." In an alleyway outside the theater, the man from the audience looms over Steve, landing a hard punch that sends him stumbling.
I think I heard a little Katharine Hepburn in there.
You never know, do you?
Yeah, it's like FBR.
FDR and Katharine Hepburn maybe had a kid.
That was fantastic. So I just want to reassure our listeners at the outset that we know Captain America fought in Europe while the Hornet fought in the Pacific Theater. But Russ also brings some great general knowledge of the war to the podcast. Russ, what are some of the magazine articles you've done?
Yeah, so over the years, I've written a couple of different articles for World at War magazine and Strategy and Tactics, which are the same publisher. My first one was an article about the M29 Weasel, which is just a very unusual tracked vehicle. We would look at it now as kind of a snowcat, but back then it was top secret. It was something very interesting. I wrote another article, Could the U.S. Have Won the Battle of Wake Island? I like to do sort of theoretical what if stuff. Wow. I also did one called The Price of French Pride, which talked about sort of the French essentially being on the Axis side for a couple of years from when the fall of France until we landed in North Africa. And then my final one that was published was about U.S. tanks in the Philippines in 1941 and 42.
Fantastic. That's a broad range of topics.
I get interested in a lot of different things. I just love World War II as a general topic. I have a pretty large library, and when something attracts my attention, I start digging into it. Then I usually will dive deeper and try to write something about it if I can. So, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Well, you're absolutely among friends of this group. That's for sure. Now, what is there any sort of one thing in particular, and this is probably an impossible question, but that drew you to that World War II era in particular?
I have this book called Great American Fighter Pilots of World War II that was published, I think, in the late 50s. And I had this tattered copy of it when I was a kid, and I read it, and it reads like a adventure novel, a story of heroes, maybe even superheroes. We're talking about Captain America. And ever since then, that just sparked my interest in World War II, and it just started from there. So that tells the story from the beginning, you know, from Pearl Harbor until the end of the war, about U.S. fighter pilots. Very high level, very simple, but it really sparked my imagination as like a 9-year-old kid or whatever it was when I first read it. And then, yeah, I just never stopped studying and reading more about World War II. I don't know. I never stopped having the interest after that.
That's the book by Robert D. Loomis, right?
Wow. Oh my God. Amazing. Yes. I'm 99% sure you're right.
I took notes.
Okay.
Good
I
job,
read up on
Brian.
you, Russell.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's probably in the preface of my book. Yeah, you're right. Okay. Yeah.
And
But
your
yeah, that
mother's
was
made
it.
a
And I
name.
vividly
Yes.
remember reading that. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And you're now literally surrounded by World War II history. I mean, being as we're recording this, you're sitting in. You could explain where you're seated right now in.
So for those of us that work at the USS Hornet Museum, our offices are scattered around the ship. Mine happens to be in a officer's quarters, the damage control officer. So I actually have two bunks behind me and the sort of the desk and the sink and the stuff that the officer used to have. So these are pretty nice quarters as far as sailors are concerned. You know, the enlisted men would be stacked three or four bunks high in big rooms, but the officers got a little bit of privacy. You just had to share your room with one other person. So yeah, this is kind of a dream job. This is sort of my retirement job, as I describe it. I was in the corporate world for a long time, and then I left and wanted to try something different where my interests could come into the forefront. And working on a World War II ship pretty much checks all the boxes.
Oh, for sure. Wow.
And she's a beauty.
Yeah.
Jim, do you have anything related to this minute you wanted
Well, yeah,
to?
and Russell, I know that I kind of threw you a curveball when we first talked about having you on the show. One of the things at the beginning of this minute, we're talking with Steve is desperately trying to enlist, and the examiner, the military examiner at the recruiting office, says, "I'm saving your life," and stamps his file for F. And I know there's a bunch of different levels of this. The only ones that I know about are the level two, which is if you were in a war critical industry, like you were an engineer on a railroad or you worked in a coal mine, you were disqualified from enlisting because your work at home was needed more than sending you overseas. Could you go over what you found out about the different types of ratings for enlistment?
Yeah, to your point, my knowledge wasn't super deep on this topic, but like everybody else, I have some understanding, and then I just dug a little bit deeper to find out more. There's like 50 different classifications.
Wow.
So starting from 1A, available for military service, all the way into the 4s, 4F, you know, unfit for service due to reading the description, physical, mental, or moral reasons. But in between that, there's so many designations. There's lots of different kinds of conscientious objectors. There could be age restrictions. You already pointed out the one about critical industries that you might be involved in and other skills. And then there's all kinds of things in between, like you could be available for some military service, but not full military service. So there are a bunch, but of course, the 1A and the 4F are the ones that most people talk about and know about.
Do we know? I haven't asked you this before. Do we know how many people were declared 4F? I mean, I just was wondering how many people they turned down versus what people that enlisted.
So when the World War II started, well, even before World War II started, when we thought we were going to get into World War II, the war plans figured that we were going to need about 10 million people to be brought into the military. And so what we ended up doing to get 10 million people was to draft 19 million. So that means somewhere in the neighborhood of 9 million people were turned down for various reasons. I don't know the exact number that were 4-H'd, but it was a significant chunk of that, right? And there, like we already talked about, there were a lot of other reasons to get knocked out. But basically, over 40% of people were rejected for various reasons.
So
So
you
just a
draft two to
massive
get
number.
one, sounds like. Right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I know in my own family's experience, my dad got pulled out of high school when the day he turned 18, he didn't even get to graduate, and they said you're off to Fort Dix and then on to England and France. Everybody in his neighborhood disappeared because they were all able-bodied and 18.
Yeah.
So, I think that the range was pretty wide. If you could stand on your own 2 feet and your blood pressure wasn't going anywhere and you could hold a rifle, I think off you went.
Well, I don't want to sandbag you either, Russ,
No.
because we haven't pre-discussed this, but
Go for it.
I'm wondering what the if there was what the upper range was, because my grandfather was, I think, in his early 30s and still, I don't know if he enlisted or was drafted. I think he enlisted, but he was considered an old man. Like I think just probably right at the upper range of what would have been acceptable. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, they actually changed it a couple of times because, as you can imagine, at the beginning of the war, there were plenty of people that fit the criteria that you needed. But as the war went on, it got harder and harder to get enough people to fulfill the jobs you needed to do in the military. My grandfather, for example, was initially building ships in Massachusetts for most of the war. And then in 1944, he got drafted into the Navy, even though he was a little bit older and he already had a child. But they were having a harder time getting people to fill the positions. But I think I'm looking this up now. Initially, they were looking at people, they were kind of focusing on 21 to 36 years old. Then they expanded it all the way to 64, but then they realized that was way too high. So they really focused on kind of the 18 to 45. But really, for most roles, they were looking for the younger groups and, you know, that people that were inducted into the military, if you were in your 30s, the other people in your squads were calling you an old man, and you know, they always thought that was kind of silly. But that theoretically it was focused primarily on 21 to 36. But then it expanded and contracted. I want to say my grandfather was probably pretty close to that 36-year-old age when he was brought into the Navy at the end of the war.
Yeah, I think my grandpa was too. He was Army Air Corps, and probably right there in that mid-30 target.
I just remember my grandmother telling me the story. She was so mad because she had my mother, who was 1 year old, and that was her. And all of a sudden, her husband was taken into the Navy, and so she was very upset, thinking that why would they take him as he has a newborn. So, I wish I could have talked to him. He has passed away now, to ask him a little bit more about that. But that's all
Man,
I know.
but what a kind of a cool circle of life for you that you're spending your career working on a World War II naval vessel.
Absolutely. Yeah, my uncle went into the Navy too. He was younger, so he was more Vietnam era. But yeah, there has been some family tradition of that. I wasn't in the military, so this is probably the next closest thing I can do to that. But yeah.
Well, while we have you on the Hornet, I think this not tied directly to the minute, except we're in World War II. Could we go over the background of the Hornet and the important roles it played both at the be you know at the very beginning of the Pacific War and its roles in the Pacific battles?
Sure. There were two aircraft carriers named Hornet in World War II. The first one was CV-8, the eighth aircraft carrier that we built, and that was one that took part in the famous Doolittle Raid, the Battle of Midway, but then was sunk off, fighting for Guadalcanal at the Battle of Santa Cruz Islands in October of 42. And when that ship was sunk, this ship, which is actually USS Hornet CV-12, was under construction. And so we were initially supposed to be named the USS Kearsarge. But when that ship was sunk, the Navy changed the name of this one to Hornet. The Navy likes to recycle their more famous names, Lexington, Yorktown, Hornet. All those ships were sort of recycled. Also, maybe to confuse the enemy a little bit, I don't know. So then
Didn't
this
we just
Hornet
sink
was launched.
that
Right? We thought we sunk the Hornet. What's the Hornet doing in battle
And it looks
anyway?
bigger now.
Yeah, exactly. And so this Hornet was launched in late 43 and then started fighting in early 44. So, and then basically from 44, from March 44 to June 45, this Hornet took part in basically every big Pacific battle. So the, Marianas Turkey Shoot, the invasion of the Philippines, Okinawa, Iwo Jima, raids on the Japanese home islands, all of those carrier battles for that last year and a half. And the Hornet was a very lucky ship. It was never hit by a torpedo, a bomb, or a kamikaze. It did get strafed a couple of times, but it actually was knocked out by a typhoon, Halsey's typhoon, so-called, when he sent the fleet into the typhoon. And a known design flaw on the Essex-class carriers was that the front of the flight deck was not super well supported on the sides, and a wave crashed down and collapsed the front 30 or 40 feet of the flight deck, and that knocked the Hornet out of the war.
I've seen pictures of that, and the front of the Hornet just looks like it was on a hinge. It just dropped down. It
Yep.
didn't detach from the ship, but it was just like straight down. It's kind of stunning that it survived.
And there was an argument between the engineers and the aircraft people when they were designing the Essex class. And so the engineers wanted to taper the front of the flight deck because it would have been stronger, because the ship's bow tapers, right? But the air guys wanted the wider flight deck to make takeoffs easier. So the air guys won the battle, but then the engineers were proved right when the wave collapsed the flight deck. So.
Now you can give me the right words for this, but at the time the Hornet was a straight, it had one runway. It didn't have the
Yes.
angled runway.
Yeah, straight deck. The angled one was added in the late 50s. British invention, the idea of the planes landing are at an angle, the ones taking off are forward. In the old days when it was rectangular, the landing planes, if they missed the hook, missed the wires with their hook, would crash into the planes waiting to take off or parked. So the angled flight deck means if you miss the wires, you just take off, come around and try it again. Pretty great invention, but pretty crazy to think that you're landing on an angled flight deck on a ship that's going up and down and moving forward while you're coming in at, 150 miles an hour or something. But Navy pilots are renowned for being a little bit crazy for a reason. But yeah.
I'd like to see
Absolutely.
Hal give that a shot. Hal,
Oh my
you
gosh.
ever want to try it? Because you
Maybe
fly
just
everything.
once. You know, I've done the closest I've ever come is I've flown the Navy's full motion F-18 simulator a couple of times and you know, tried a carrier trap there and had about a 50% success rate. So I guess that's not
I
terrible,
know.
but geez.
I know it goes without saying, but during World War II, we're just talking propeller craft. Not there were no jets. They weren't invented yet. I know that, but
Yeah,
just.
when the Hornet was upgraded for the first time during the Korean War, it was to start handling jets. So, we even started the Korean War still, the carriers were mostly carrying what, Bearcats and Corsairs. But then they pretty quickly started to switch to some of the earlier jet models. I think the Panthers and the Cougars and whatnot. We have one docent here who just retired, was a Korean War pilot that flew the Panther. He flew off the Hornet, but right after the Korean War.
Oh wow, that's great! And you would have started seeing the Douglas Sky Raiders right there, the early Sky Raiders in the part of the Korean War. I'm wondering, Russ, if you'd ever come across anything like this with the Hornet. We just did a screening here a few months ago of the bridges at Toko Re, and you know, wrapped up in some other things commemorating the anniversary of the start of the Korean War. And there's a great scene in there that, you don't hear that much about otherwise, but it was amazing that this was something that they did, and they actually recreated it for the film. Was when they're coming to moor the ship, there was an issue where if it was the channel or there's something about it sort of too narrow. It couldn't get a tugboat and the aircraft carrier in the right spot. So on the, I believe if I remember correctly, it was on the bow of the ship. You had two rows of these big Douglas Sky Raiders, which were, you know, like World War II fighters, but on steroids, massive things, big radial engines and things. And they were sitting there facing each other with the engines running. And you had a guy down there, it was like he was conducting a symphony. And at first, you have the guys on the starboard side, you know, go to full throttle. And that's actually moving the bow of the ship with a prop blast and then doing it again on the left-hand side. And I haven't dug into that enough to see how prominent that was. I just wondered, did you ever come across stories like that
I have
with
not heard that
the
story.
asset?
That's amazing if true.
Well,
I
it's
believe it. Those piston engines are huge on the Sky Raiders, but I've
yeah.
never heard that. I'm going to ask the docents
Yeah,
here. That's
see what
very
they say
interesting.
about it. You know, in the film though, I mean, they present it as being realistic and they really do it. This wasn't miniatures or, you know, rear projection or something. You see them actually really doing this thing. And then you've got, I don't know if he would have been called a CAG back then yet in the early part of Korea, but the, sort of the, whoever your sort of your chief pilot was, is going and yelling at the skipper, you know, those engines have a finite number of hours on them and you're running them at full throttle and you know, every minute you run them there is one less minute we're going to use it in combat and things like that. And that aspect of it felt very plausible to me. So next time you come across bridges at Toko Re, give it a look. It's pretty remarkable.
You're making me want to watch it. I'm sure I've seen it, but it's been a long time, so I don't
Yeah.
remember that. And then I'll try to verify with the guys here.
I'd
We have some people
love to
that
know.
were on
So,
ships that long ago, and so maybe they would know or remember.
you mentioned the Hornet. I think you said started the Korean War, but the Hornet more or less sat out the Korean War, correct?
Yeah, so
It was being retrofitted, and then it was in what, the Mediterranean?
what happened was once the Korean War started, we had mothballed so many of our ships that all of a sudden we realized, oh, we need to bring some of them back, but some of them weren't ready, for example, the Hornet. So when the Korean War started, it activated the Hornet to get upgraded, but it took a couple of years to do that upgrade. So by the time it was done, the Korean War was over. And then since we had done the upgrade, on the East Coast, they decided to send the Hornet served its entire career in the Pacific Fleet, but they decided to send it to the Pacific the other way. So they sent it across the Atlantic and through the Mediterranean and through, the canal and everything, instead of sending it through the Panama Canal. So just for fun, they got to see Naples and, and Ceylon and all that kind of stuff. So yeah. But no, they did miss the Korean War and then served through most of the Cold War and then three tours in Vietnam and then, of course, finished picking up the Apollo 11 and 12 astronauts.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I'm always concerned on the space race and things, and I was just wondering, they were, the way I was understanding it, they were doing support with the Seventh Fleet during the Vietnam era. I was just wondering how they took time out to go pick up the Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 astronauts in the midst of all that. Or was it just another assignment, or?
Yeah, so what usually happened is your deployments in off the coast of Vietnam were roughly 6 months. So, that leaves you a whole half a year that you're not involved in that. So when they designated the Hornet to be the Apollo 11 recovery ship, it coincided well with, outside of the tour. And then they decided not to send them back for another tour because then they came back later the same year in November to pick up Apollo 12. So the timing worked out well. And then the Hornet did so well on Apollo 11. They said, why? It's not broken. Let's not fix it. Let's send the same ship. Those guys seem to know what they're doing. So, yep.
Well, Russ,
Oh.
again, correct me if I'm wrong. My knowledge on all this is hazy, but I know the Hornet pretty well. But by early late 60s, when we're starting to talk about picking up Apollo and Apollo 12, the Hornet was more or less obsolete as an aircraft carrier. It couldn't handle the jets. The jets were too powerful. They needed a bigger place to land. Is that
Yeah,
correct?
so yeah, you're right. The Hornet had changed. A lot of the World War II SX class carriers that were still around had been transformed into anti-submarine specialists. So instead of handling the big attack jets and the big fighters, we didn't have F-4 Phantoms. We had S-2 trackers looking for submarines and helicopters. And so and our job was kind of to, in a way, almost protect the larger ships looking for Russian submarines. That's kind of what we were focused on. And we usually had a couple of Skyhawks, so we would fly the occasional combat mission, but essentially the Hornet did a lot of search and rescue. So, our helicopters could help recover the pilots from the other carriers that where their aircraft were shot down or damaged during missions over Vietnam. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We weren't really a combat, frontline combat carrier anymore. At least as far as air-to-air combat or land targets, it was focused primarily on submarines.
Wow, that's interesting. I'd never heard about that sort of repurposing, but I had wondered about it. How exactly did that work as these carriers were phasing out? And as you said, we're going to things like the CVNs and these 1,000 foot long ships
They're
that are
so much
so
bigger.
big to
Yeah.
accommodate, as Brian said, to accommodate the bigger, heavier jets, which need so much more runway. Even with the catapult and even with the resting hooks, you still need more real estate to land on.
Well,
You know, it's funny.
that also explains the I always wondered why they after the Hornet had done Apollo 11 and 12, 13, and I think most of the rest of them were picked up by the Iwo Jima, which was a helicopter aircraft carrier.
Right.
And that's not,
Yes,
that
you
doesn't have much
mostly
of a
needed your helicopters and maybe some early warning aircraft to recover the astronauts. The actual our Hornet was supposed to pick up Apollo 13, and so, but the that mission was delayed with the launch, and so in the time that it was delayed, the Hornet was finally taken out of service. Otherwise, we would have picked up 11, 12, and 13, but instead it was just 11 and 12.
You mentioned helicopters, and I'm going to put you on the spot, but I think you're the man for the job.
Uh-oh.
Apollo 11, in particular, was picked up by a very famous Sikorsky Sea King helicopter, number six. Every film footage you ever, or 66,
66,
every
yep.
film footage you see of Apollo 11 has this big white chopper 66. Tell the story of 66, and how come the Hornet has a 66 on it right now?
Yeah, so that is the very famous helicopter of that mission. There were actually four of these helicopters on each pickup because you had to have some redundancy. You had one filming, you had one with the Navy team, you had one with the second Navy team. So there were four of them, but we always see 66. And sadly, 66 is at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean now. So on a mission subsequent to the Apollo 11 pickup, it crashed and is still down there. And I remember when I was at the Naval History and Heritage Command in Washington last year, I was talking to them about that, and they are funding an expedition to go down and find it. They don't want to bring it back up. They just want to find it and film it where it is because it's such a famous helicopter. So our helicopter was used in the movie Apollo 13. So it's actually a movie prop. So first of all, it was really in service. One of our docents that works here worked on that exact helicopter. And then after that, it went to Hollywood, served in the movie Apollo 13. And then it came to us. And of course, we repainted it to look like it's Helicopter 66 because that is the famous one. But obviously, that one is not around anymore. So it's our best replica that we can come up with, I guess.
But it's the same model. It's just delightful. You can sit up there and pretend you're Neil Armstrong in the basket, and it's just it's one of my favorite exhibits you've got.
Oh, they have a
it's a
Billy
beautiful
Pugh
helicopter.
basket. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, now I got to come out to Alameda.
Yeah, we got to make a trip. We got to make a
Yeah,
trip back,
you
and you
guys
got
are
to make
more
it
than
for
welcome. Come on anytime you want.
I don't want to, I absolutely don't want to steal anyone's thunder. We could even clip this if need be, but Brian, I need to make sure we don't get through this episode without understanding your family connection to Russell's work and his workplace.
Well, I'm going to ask that connection if she wants this clipped or not. She might. But yeah, my daughter Laura Fees is currently the CEO of the USS Hornet Museum after really starting at the bottom there as an intern when she was getting her master's in museum studies. So she's been there for, gosh, going on something like 15 years, at least 12, I think, working her way up. And now I can't tell you what joy it brings me to tell people my kid has the keys to an aircraft carrier. I sort of became her space consultant. I, like Jim, I'm a big space nerd, and the Hornet has a wealth of artifacts tucked away in every nook and cranny. And once in a while, especially in the early days, Laura would call me or have me come aboard and show me something and say, "Is this anything?" And I would either say, "No, Mattel made a million of those," or I would say, "Oh my God, that belongs in the Smithsonian." You could go either way on a lot of this stuff, but so I'm all aboard for the space age stuff as much as I love the naval history. But as I say, after we're done talking, I'll contact Laura and see if she'd go along with having any of this in the podcast.
Totally fair.
Well,
Our producer has big scissors,
yes.
right, Jim?
Yeah, well, Brian, you might want to mention one of the bigger little pieces of Apollo history that's out there, a sign or two that
Yes.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking of. Laura takes me down into the archives, and I see sitting on a shelf a sign that says Hornet plus three. And there is a series of famous pictures of Richard Nixon greeting the crew of Apollo 11 after they get off the capsule, or after they get out of the helicopter. I'm sorry, they're marched directly into a mobile quarantine facility, which the Hornet has one of, although not Apollo 11s. So you have Apollo 14s, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah.
Same exact design and everything. Looks exactly the same, but
It's an
it's a
Airstream
different
trailer.
mission.
And so there are many pictures of Richard Nixon looking at Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin through the window of this Airstream trailer. And above the window is a sign that says Hornet plus three that somebody on the crew had made. Same thing for Apollo 12. There was a sign that said three more like before. Is that right,
Right.
Russ?
Yep,
That's right.
you got it.
And so these signs are sitting on the shelf. And that's when I said, "Oh my God, this belongs in the Smithsonian." The Smithsonian has them, but they have fakes. We got the real ones on the Hornet. And I could tell that because the photo of Nixon is so good. You can see the wood grain on the sign and it matches. I
Wow.
matched the wood grain on the sign. So I personally paid to have a display case made to put these signs up in the Apollo exhibit space they have there. And it just gives me a tingle every time I go in there. I love that I touched this little piece of history.
Yeah,
You're
it's, I
marking
mean, it's.
stuff today. I didn't know you paid. I didn't know you did that, Brian. That's cool.
It was like 300 bucks.
Yeah.
Money well
Well
spent.
spent.
I mean, it's the space equivalent of the Star Spangled Banner. It's just one of those things that everybody's seen. If you flip through any book about Apollo, there's the Hornet and there's that the both signs. But very impressive. Wow. Well, Russell, thank you so much for being on the show. We did talk a little bit about the minute. I'm pretty sure we covered
I hope we
some
did
part.
enough.
I think
It's
we've
all
covered
World
all
War II.
bases. When people want to go visit the Hornet, could you give us an idea where they can find out about it online?
Sure, our website is USS-Hornet.org. A lot of info on there. We're generally open Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We do a lot of tours and other things on the other days, though. So if you wanted to come on a different day, you could set up a private tour. Like we talked about, there's great information here from World War II, the Cold War, the Vietnam War, the space program. I mean, whatever you're interested in, you'll find something about it. Some of our aircraft are outside of those time periods. So we have an F-14 Tomcat, we have an F-18 now. And so no matter what you're interested in, you'll probably find something here that you like.
You also do overnight programs that, like a lot of Boy Scout, Girl Scout troops will come and spend a night on the ship. I think families can too as well, can't they?
Correct. Yes,
Yeah.
I meet more people around the Bay Area that if I say I work at the Hornet, they're like, oh, when I was a kid, I spent the night there. That's how everybody remembers it. So absolutely, 100%.
But we do have to remind people that it is not a nuclear vessel. That's
no.
But it's
Sorry,
where
Chekhov.
It's in Alameda, though.
Yeah, it's in
Alameda.
Alameda.
That was.
Wow. Well, great. Well, again, thanks everybody for thanks for us for being on our show. And also, I'd like to thank our audience. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. And also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.